Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Cenovus.com. Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Cenovus.com.
Today on the Gillette Health Podcast, we discuss health updates. For example, do I have an STD? I might be concerned if I don't. And other things like what our lipid levels are. Are we on cholesterol medication, etc.?
Yeah. Both yourself and myself, Kyle, have had some surgeries recently. So we recap those, the recoveries, all the peptides we are or are not taking to recover from those, and my chest injury BPC protocol. We chatted a bit about that briefly. So this will be a fun one.
Welcome back to the Gillette Health Podcast, where we give you tools to develop a balanced approach for health. I'm Dr. Kyle Gillette.
And I'm James O'Hara, nurse practitioner. And Kyle, I couldn't help but notice the sunglasses today. What's going on there?
Yeah, my eyes are very sensitive to light, probably because of that eye surgery that I had yesterday.
A performance-enhancing surgery?
Yes, actually so, although that's not the main reason. It will make me much better at basketball and volleyball, like back in the glory days in my 20s.
Yeah, you'll be even more of a threat on the basketball court. Not only do you have the height, but your three-pointer will be on point.
Yes.
Top notch.
Yeah, it seems like it will be. But yeah, I had a surgery for something called esophoria, type of adult strabismus. But apparently this happens fairly often in physicians after they finish medical school and residency. They're always looking really close in, and the eye muscles that converge get stronger than the eye muscles that diverge. So they took, as some of you might be able to see, they took my eye muscles on the inside and loosened them up and weakened them. So it was an atrophy-causing surgery, I guess. And now my muscles are stronger going to the outsides. So that's what's happened. But yeah, the eyes are still very sensitive to the light, given that was yesterday.
And this comes from a lot of studying in med school. So I suppose this means if your doctor has not developed this, then they were not spending enough time in front of the computer or in front of the textbooks.
Yeah, I don't know if I could say that, but it's definitely good to have that back, because whenever I'd shoot a three-pointer or whatnot, about half the time I'd aim at the correct goal, and then about half the time I'd aim at the incorrect goal. So when I hit, it was good, but yeah, a lot less double vision now.
Yeah, so that is, I guess, your surgical health update. My surgical health update, I guess, is a bit more overdue, but I am fully recovered from gynecomastia surgery now.
Yeah. It seems like your recovery took a bit longer than my one-day recovery for this.
Yeah. I think people looking back now will be able to kind of put two and two together and be like, oh, yeah, James was wearing sweaters and a white T-shirt underneath those during those episodes.
True.
Due to that compression garment. Yeah, that thing was a necessary evil, I suppose.
But so, yeah, so I guess you somewhat explained your CAG repeats and whatnot, but was this pubertal gyno? Was this prophylactic so that you can now blast huge amounts of gear and become an IBBF pro, whatever it's called? I don't know what it's called.
Yeah. No to the latter, yes to the former. So I did develop gynecomastia during puberty. I know it just seems like one day I woke up and I had one sort of boob that was there and one nipple that was like significantly larger than the other one. And I was like, this is weird. So I went to the doctor, and the doctor says, oh yeah, this happens. Yep. It's going to go away. And
they gave you some raloxifene, didn't they?
Nope. They I don't even know if they gave me a pat on the back, but that's about the closest thing they gave me to treatment. Basically nothing, you know, monitor it, and it will go away. And it never went away completely. I think I ended up developing it on the contralateral other side, although it was always a little bit worse on the left. Mm-hmm. So I've kind of had this, you know, on and off, and really didn't start having a lot of, you know, nipple pain or nipple sensitivity until being, you know, on testosterone and then being on both dutasteride and finasteride seemed to not necessarily cause more tissue growth, but definitely increase the sensitivity if you're thinking about the balances of the androgens and the estrogens there. Mm-hmm. So being the rational and calculated person I am, I said, well, I'm either going to have to get multiple hair transplants or I'm going to have to get gynecomastia surgery. So I figure I'll get one gynecomastia surgery and mm-hmm. one hair transplant at some point.
That's very reasonable. So why do you say you would need a hair transplant? Is that because you do not want to take an aromatase inhibitor? Because Dr. Huberman said on the Joe Rogan podcast that prolactin is the cause of gynecomastia.
No, that's interesting. My prolactin numbers have always been low. I don't think I've ever had a high prolactin, probably because I'm not a marijuana or kratom user. Those are very common causes now.
How about IGF-1? Do you think that was high during puberty? That can cause gynecomastia. Yeah, isn't that how Anadrol supposedly causes gynecomastia?
The mystery gyno from Anadrol?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think you get a lot of growth signaling from that. And certainly having higher IGF-1 would tend to. Now my IGF-1 tends to be ballpark around 200, mm-hmm. which I suppose is relatively high, not unexpected, you know, being in my 20s.
Did you have metabolic syndrome in adolescence when you worked at McDonald's for a year? Serious question, by the way.
I was actually very, very thin. So I was probably less than 100 pounds when I developed mm-hmm. gynecomastia. I know when I was 16, I was like probably about the same height as I am now, you know, just shy of 6 feet and 120 pounds. So I was very sort of skinny. I was what you would call a hard gainer, which means I didn't eat enough.
I see. Yeah, that was pretty skinny. Yeah.
And
I was probably skin and bones, 180, maybe 185. Just pure skin and bones. Yeah, I was pretty athletic though, thinking back on it. Yeah, I was like a shrunk down version of Victor Wembanyama in the NBA, if people know who that is. He's like so 7'5" freak.
About a foot shorter.
Yeah, but the same stature. Yeah, with much smaller hands. His hands are like dinner plates. Anyway,
I did partake in the McDonald's food, but that wasn't until I was between the ages of 16 and 17. I probably ate there 3-4 times a week, depending on how many shifts I was making or working, and depending on who the manager was, if they let me also get a breakfast sandwich while I was working in the mornings.
Yeah.
Some of them are like, oh, yeah, you're fine. And then some of them are like, no, that's stealing. You're going to drive this company into the ground.
Goodness gracious. Wow, I can't believe that actually happened. How long was the recovery? Was it a couple weeks? Like what was the, for people that are considering this, what was the bad part of it?
Yeah, not being able to fully exercise for 6 weeks. So the day after the procedure, I was doing some cardio on a stationary bike. That's fine to do. Basically, you don't have to be totally sedentary for 6 weeks. Within a week, I was doing legs again. Probably 3 weeks post-op, I was doing some light upper body stuff. Not a lot of pushing, like pressing movements, not a lot of rowing movements. And then 6 weeks with the surgeon's blessing is when I was able to go back and start incorporating pushing, pressing, full range of movement, mm-hmm. Some stretching, like even hanging from a pull-up bar is something that I like to do for shoulder health and mobility. It just feels good. Mm-hmm. That was slightly uncomfortable at 6 weeks because it does put a lot of tension on those surgical scars there.
Yep.
And there was some tissue adhesion. And now that's starting to regress a little bit. I do have some scar tissue. I've actually thought about just sort of hitting it with a massage gun. Mm. that may be a scenario where my prolactin spikes due to the nipple stimulation, although less so since I don't have mammary glands. Maybe I'll do a 30-minute massage gun session and then check my prolactin the next day.
Yeah. Let me know how that goes. Other things that increase prolactin, for those wondering, tonic-clonic seizures, orgasms, particularly strong orgasms, and potentially certain types of like really hard workouts, maybe just a touch, but more likely related to nipple stimulation. That's how a lot of midwives try to kind of simulate, well, not just prolactin, but also oxytocin release. I forget what method it's called.
Oh, and then sauna. That one, I think, is very short-lived because I've done a sauna session in the evening, labs the next morning, and prolactin was also normal. So I don't think that it's causing a sustained release in prolactin. So if you got your prolactin at least 8 hours after a sauna session, it's probably not elevated due to the sauna.
Yep. Yeah, I don't think I've ever had a high prolactin, although I did get some labs recently, so maybe it did elevate. I don't know.
Yeah, let me just pull up the prolactin here. Let's see.
When I got these labs, I would say I was less healthy than I have ever been in the last 3 years. Been getting up a lot at night. My sleep is terrible, and I have exercised very little. I did the Battle Bunker Hybricon Games, designed by Hunter, the High Rocks guy. I think I did that, what, 2 or 3 weeks ago? 2.5 weeks ago?
Yeah.
And after that, I was taking it easy for a bit and doing a bit more running. But far fewer gym sessions in the morning, and I've been eating a lot more sugar and junk. So I expect these to be pretty bad. And also, I was trying to take it easy and let my heart rate metrics, my heart rate variability, my resting heart rate kind of go back down to like true normal before getting the surgery. So I did that, and then I started back up with CrossFit class this morning.
I was going to ask you, you reassured all the CrossFitters listening. They thought that Dr. Gillette was going to bail out of CrossFit and become a Hybricon athlete.
Well, I'm still probably going to do that. I do plan to do a High Rocks, and at some point I'll probably... I've ran a half marathon before. I'll probably jog another one of those and maybe a few other things. But I'll still do the CrossFit stuff.
Yeah, as for me, I'm just training for the Gillette Health Games. I think we can call them that.
Yeah. The fitness assessment. It's a modified Army fitness test, the ACFT, except we've removed... It's supposed to be gender and age neutral. We've removed the push-ups because those are not gender neutral. And we've also switched back to the old version, which has the leg tucks instead of the plank. Much better assessment of like fitness, grip strength, core strength, rather than just are you willing to grit through the pain with
The plank is really a willpower test, right?
Yeah, it sucks. Yeah, so I guess it's not bad to test willpower, especially for the military, but for a fitness assessment, you shouldn't be testing things like planks or snatches or... kipping pull-ups. But again, no need to dive into that too much.
We did substitute the push-ups for incline barbell and dumbbell bench press. People can choose their strength.
Yes.
Which I think is much more exciting than push-ups. It'll certainly be much more exciting to watch.
Yeah.
Because there are a lot of people that are going to for sure max that event, but there are people who are going to be very close, so it'll be exciting to see how that goes.
Yeah, definitely.
All right. So I guess we can hop into some of your labs. So this is the trough of your health from the last 3 years.
Yep.
LDL. So actually, we have the lipid panel here.
This is off my meds, too.
Total cholesterol, 174. Triglycerides, 79. Higher. HDL, 41. Yep. VLDLs, 15. LDL, 118. An ApoB, I'll just mention, was 96.
96. Terrible.
So how do you feel about this lipid panel? This is your natty lipid panel.
I feel like I'm dying. I'm starting my ezetimibe. Mostly because of the ApoB. The HDL, I think a lot of it is due to my less exercise in recent weeks since the Hybricon Games. And... the LDL is actually a lot better than I thought. The ApoB is about what I thought. but it's because I've been consuming large amounts of sugar and carbs. And usually I do eat pretty medium to low carb, especially for, you know, when I eat my carbs, I usually eat my carbs before and after exercise, but I just kind of kept doing that. And then I didn't exercise as much. So I'm going to hop on my ezetimibe again. And with my Achilles tendonitis, that is almost all the way better. I think I've been off my every other night 5 mg rosuvastatin for almost 6 months now. And my lipids have looked pretty good. And I don't think that the rosuvastatin is what caused my left-sided Achilles tendonitis. But as I'm rehabbing it, I kind of just don't want that to be a confounding variable.
Yeah, I think that's fair, as long as you don't let the 6 months sort of spill into rehabbing your Achilles for the next 6 years or six decades.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. And here in the next 5 years or so, when I get my first CCTA with plaque analysis and whatever else is needed, that'll certainly be a more important decision tree point. But for many years, I've tolerated my rosuvastatin well. I suppose the other reason why I was off it is, another reason is I was conceiving a child. I was on a fertility phase, which perhaps I'll go into later. Or maybe I'll convince the wife to do a podcast, which would be pretty interesting at some point.
Yeah.
No promises for that.
Yeah. So you think I don't know if you explicitly mentioned, but you think the increased sugar intake contributed to the higher triglycerides, but also contributed to the lower LDL.
Yes. Yeah, it wasn't Oreos. It might have been a Butterfinger here or there in a Ninja Creami, but yeah, it did.
Gotcha. And then, let's see. I don't know if we want to bounce back and forth lipids to lipids or just go straight down through your results. How do we want to format it?
Whichever. I will say, in regards to my lipids and the carbs like being seen in a good way, I would actually rather have my insulin be 3 or 2, which it usually is. My insulin was 6-something, which is horrible for me. And I can just tell that my insulin resistance is starting to build up. Even from a cardiovascular health standpoint, I would rather my lipids be slightly worse and my insulin be better. So I'd rather my insulin be 3 and my lipids be a bit worse than my insulin be 6.5 or 7 and my lipids be better. So the carbs were not worth it to lower lipids. However, why not both? I'd rather have both and just take ezetimibe and have my lipids be good and have my insulin be good too.
Yeah, I'm also a proponent of technology, of which pharmaceuticals are a form of technology. Next, we have your...
If you're anti-medication, you're anti-technology.
Yeah.
You're basically Amish. Go ahead.
Your kidney function, what's going on there? Your EGFR is dangerously close to kidney disease. Creatinine 1.35, BUN23. Glucose, nice and low, though. That insulin is still working.
Yeah, I guess I just have borderline chronic kidney disease, stage 3B, CKD, 3B. It's a bummer. No, I wasn't even taking that much creatine at the time.
Yeah, and
we're working out.
I actually haven't seen the creatine contribute to the creatinine. I hear that claim made a lot, but I've had patients where they weren't supplementing it. They start supplementing it. Doesn't seem to move the needle that much. I suppose it's dose dependent and probably depends on the person as well. But you also have a substantial amount of lean body mass. I think you even posted a DEXA on Instagram not too long ago.
Just to flex
on.
Should have posted my InBody though.
Oh, an InBody.
Go ahead.
I see a lot of health influencers that talk a lot about lean body mass, but never post any DEXAs. What's up with that?
It's like they don't want to show the receipts. Or it didn't happen.
Yeah.
That's funny. So yeah, if you're an influencer that talks about the benefits of exercise, protein, and lean body mass, post your lean body mass. If your lean muscle mass plus your pounds of dry bone don't add up to 200, then what's the saying? I forget the saying as I'm saying it. Then you're not a influencer.
Yeah, well,
it's like
we'll,
if you're lifting we'll weights,
a jingle for that.
If you're lifting weights and you complain about someone grunting or dropping the weights, unless you can lift more than them, you cannot complain.
Yeah, I've heard people speak to this effect. Someone was talking about, oh yes, this was Dr. Peter Attia. Someone was pointing out like, I don't know how you can use AirPods because of the EMFs or this and that. And he's like, I wish people would just do 50 push-ups before they would comment something like that.
Because?
It's more important to be able to do 50 push-ups than to worry about EMFs.
I guess you could say, what does that have to do with anything? Why not both? Why not just drink a glass of water before they comment that? It's more important to do that too.
To be hydrated.
Yeah.
Make sure you're hydrated, optimally slept, your lipids are in order, and then you get your commenting privileges.
A random commenter, you should not put too much stock in any random commenter. Now, there's comments that are great, and a lot of times we read comments on these videos and posts, and we think, man, that is a fantastic idea, like the one about our studio setup.
Yeah, that was good.
Then you also read comments, and it reminds you that whether it's nature or nurture, there are certainly some humans which are better and worse critical thinkers.
That's fair. Now for what we thought might be the most exciting part of the podcast, but turned out to be pretty anticlimactic, your HSV results. So HSV1, HSV2, stone cold negative.
False negative, 10% chance, right?
Yeah. So there's
at least a 10% chance that these are false negatives.
A 90% chance that you are in the 10 or 15% that does not have a positive HSV1.
Yeah. And that I know of, I mean, most people are positive. So, you know, only like you mentioned, depending on what area of the world you live in, you would expect about a 90% positivity rate for at least one, at least HSV1, but if not both. If not HSV2 causing a false positive HSV1. But anyway, yeah, I was pretty surprised to see that these are negatives. I suppose if I was a female, I would be concerned for contracting a primary infection during pregnancy. So if I was a female and I was pregnant, I would be worried about getting my first infection of this. It'd be much more severe, potentially life-threatening to the fetus.
Yeah. Now, you've never experienced like a cold sore, like a fever, blister, nothing like that?
Not that I know of, but most people haven't, even that test positive for HSV1.
I was going to say that's my circumstances, that I can't recall ever getting a cold sore, fever, blister. But I am positive for the HSV1, even though I've never had a outbreak that I remember. Maybe I was a kid and I just don't remember.
Yeah, like we talked about on the HSV podcast, which is one of our most recently posted ones, most people get this by the time they're age 5 from, kissing grandma or whatnot, but Gillettes are notorious for being germaphobes. Unfortunately, those were negative.
Homocysteine, 18.7. This must be because of your MTHFR mutation.
I am a compound heterozygote, I think.
I think
you probably know better than me.
I should have pulled your
two
chart
of the main
to look
four.
And see. Yeah, but yeah, I am also you're either a homozygous recessive at the minor gene pair or compound heterozygote.
Correct.
I know that I'm a compound heterozygote.
Yeah.
So homocysteine of 18.7. And previously this has been very close to 10 in your case.
Yeah.
So that would be like an 80% increase with slightly less exercise, slightly more sugar. It doesn't seem likely to me that this is true. We also, unfortunately, don't have an APTT to sort of fact check that this blood didn't sit out for a prolonged period of time or hemolyze.
Yeah, I wouldn't be shocked if this was kind of like a slightly false positive homocysteine. But I was a little surprised. Maybe it sat out for a bit. Like you mentioned, there was no APTT. But I was consuming a little bit less creatine than normal. That's one thing that usually helps keep it down. I'm not going to put too much stock into it other than I'm going to hop back on my 7.5 grams of creatine per day. Maybe I'll take I usually don't even take a multivitamin when my diet's better, but I wouldn't be opposed to getting a little bit of methylated Bs in a multi. but I'm not going to take an expensive methylated B supplement or whatnot. And like we've mentioned before, MTHFR only correlates with homocysteine about 10% of the time. So I'll get that down below 12. You don't worry about that.
All right. And then we have the insulin, of course, we referenced was 6.4.
Right.
And then the CK, which is good evidence that you were not exercising because people that know you and know of you probably know how much you enjoy exercise and how intense you tend to exercise. Mm-hmm. I think you've had a CK that was
near 1,000.
Closer to 1,000 last time, if I remember right. Definitely above 600. It was flagged.
My baseline CKs, and I think the LabCorp range flags above 400. But yeah, my CK, it would not be unusual if it's near 1,000. That's kind of what it's expected. It's 318 this time, and that is a sign that I have been really taking it easy, not breaking down a whole lot of muscle, and probably not synthesizing a whole lot of muscle either.
Oh, you should get an in-body to verify that.
My in-body will probably tell me that I am jacked and shredded.
That you've gained. Yeah, it could go either way. Some people are jacked and shredded, and the in-body may tell them that they are, in fact, small and fat.
That's true.
Or it could tell people that are not jacked and shredded that they are jacked and shredded.
Yeah, it's a mystery bonus or punishment. So I guess watching trends of in-body over a long period of time would be decent, but probably no more so than looking in a mirror.
Yeah, I mean, I think directionally it's going to be accurate. And if you happen to be one of those lucky people with a really good correlate between your in-body indexes, then you could probably get a little bit more insightful data out of in-bodies.
Yep.
They're very quick to do. I actually did my very first in-body at our gym that we go to.
Yep.
And it's just sort of a free thing of membership. Punch in your age, punch in your gender. I think some of them have an athlete mode, but this one did not.
Yeah. Yeah, so yeah, again, it's probably better than nothing, but you can get an Omron scale, the one that you have the handles that you pull up, and those I think are $80 or $90. You can buy one for your house. Much more accurate than the in-body that you'll find at your gym or your wellness clinic or your med spa. So again, see the research of Grant Hensley. It's not just the average accuracy, if you will. It's the repeatability of the machine as well. Because arguably, if you could have something that is, you know, mostly accurate but not very repeatable, has a lot of outliers, if someone's just following the trend, repeatability is just as important.
Yeah, and actually, this is a good thing to bring up because if you did, actually, whether it was a DEX or an in-body, if you did a scan before and after each workout, like you did one before, did your workout, did a scan after, mm-hmm. it's going to look like you lost muscle during that workout.
Correct.
Because of the sweat loss, the fluid loss.
I actually tried to do this one time and one of the trainers was around and he was like, oh, you can't do those after a workout because the fluid shifts, which was technically right. But you can obviously do them at any time.
It's not dangerous to do.
It's not
after
like
workout.
Yeah.
Hearing that makes me worried. That's how I did mine, was after a workout.
probably not based on the results. The
trainer wasn't around.
You recently did both a DEXA scan and an in-body, I believe less than 3 months apart.
Yeah, I should have done them sooner. I actually did not know our gym had an in-body machine. But I got a DEXA immediately pre-surgery. I was like, well, I want to see how well my bulk went. Mm-hmm. I probably could have reined in the calories a bit, put on a little bit less body fat and the same amount of muscle. But 8 pounds of lean body mass, 8 pounds of body fat was pretty reasonable.
It's pretty good for a bulk.
I wasn't angry with that result. And I ended up at 16.8% body fat. The interesting thing to me here was that I went from a quarter pound of visceral fat to I think just under 3/4 pounds, just under 3/4 of a pound of visceral fat.
Fructose.
So it almost tripled.
Fructose.
And saturated fat.
It probably had nothing to do with the caloric surplus that you were
in. The double lunches that I would eat in the office here.
Yeah, so
eat lunch and then another hour later, like, well, I think I'll eat another lunch.
It's pretty much impossible to gain a significant amount of lean body mass without a little bit of visceral fat. The key is to lose it after you have gone through that process.
Yeah, exactly. And not to continue. Like if I continued that trajectory, I think then I would start to see some deterioration in my labs. My fasting insulin, I think it was still around 5 or 6 at peak bulk, even at quite close to 20% body fat. But also
not that close, closer to 15.
Closer to 20 than 10, rounding to the nearest.
Barely. Yeah. But that is a good point. If you exercise a lot and you eat a good, mostly whole food diet, even with some junk, you can still keep your visceral adipose score under 1 pound, which we consider the gold standard. A lot of people say 2 pounds or 1 kilogram, but under 1 pound seems very safe from a health standpoint. But I think that if you got your InBody, even 3 months ago, it would have said you're 10% body fat, you're fitness influencer ready.
Yeah, single almost ready digit. To do a photo shoot, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So if I take it at face value, in less than 3 months, let's say my DEXA was 100% accurate, my InBody was 100% accurate. Keeping in mind I had 6 weeks off of any really good training and then probably another 2 weeks of sort of ramping up to get back to, you know, what I was used to doing. So maybe 1 month of good training. Then I went from 16.8 to 10.3% body fat.
Wow.
Lost 13.5 pounds of body fat and gained 6 pounds of lean body mass. Which
that's very impressive.
I just don't see how that's possible.
Did you do that thing that Tony Huge talks about where you're like an Uber bulk?
Cycling blood thinners?
No, there's this thing that Tony Huge does and you abuse a whole bunch of PEDs and then in like 2 weeks or 4 weeks, you're supposed to gain all this lean body mass. And you did. You gained 6 pounds of dry, hard, lean muscle tissue while you were recovering from this surgery where you couldn't do anything for 6 weeks.
Yeah, I did not use any peptides recovering from the surgery. I figured I'm young, healthy enough. I'll just let nature run its course. I'll do my, post-op care like I'm supposed to, check all the right boxes, still do some cardio, not just use it as an excuse to do nothing or be inactive. I would probably have a very difficult time with that. I tend to get a little bit restless when I'm not exercising.
Me too.
And fortunately or unfortunately, maybe I'd have more lean body mass if I had abused PEDs in the past, but I have never done a whole bunch of steroids.
So you didn't do D-ball plus DECA, which is Dianabol plus Nandrolone before the surgery to grow the glandular tissue so that it'd be easier to remove?
No, but I've heard this mentioned, and to me, I think that would not be a great thing to do. I feel like removing a smaller amount of tissue is probably going to cause less trauma to the area, especially if you're concerned cosmetically about what the outcome. For me, it was mainly about resolving the pain, but I also, don't want a deformed chest,
That makes sense. You don't want to look like you've survived a double mastectomy for male breast cancer.
Yeah.
Yeah, that makes sense. How about microneedling? I know we just got a couple more of those intelligent shop microneedlers in. Those can be helpful for scars in addition to scalp, right?
Yeah, that's been part of the recovery protocol. I believe it was just after 6 weeks post-op I did my first one of those. And then my second session another 6 weeks later. So I think I am right at 3 months post-op now. And I think that is going to be helpful. These things do take a long time for the sort of hypertrophied scar tissue to flatten out.
Yep.
But you can actually, in most circumstances, microneedle a lot sooner than we used to think. There was a paper, I think this was actually in breast cancer women, mastectomy patients, and they microneedled the scars earlier versus later. And I think they eventually reached close to the same outcome, but the acceleration of the recovery and cosmetic appearance was much better with early intervention. Previously, it was thought that they would be potentially weakening the integrity of the scar tissue, but that appears to be not the case.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's always a benefit. When I think of breast cancer, I think of turkesterone because I like to put people on turkesterone after they have breast cancer. I think it's very anabolic for them and helps prevent some of the muscle wasting. But anyway, I'd like to say that to be contrarian. How's the recovery gone since then? I know you're also in physical therapy for other things, seeing our friend Will.
Yeah, the recovery seems well. My strength is probably a bit higher than it was at the, like, going into the surgery as far as upper body goes.
Mm-hmm.
But I have picked up a little bit of running in training for the Gillette Games. And the same thing happened to me that happened back in, this is over a decade now, you know, running some track in high school.
Mm-hmm.
I was not a distance runner. I actually would walk cross-country practices occasionally and jog, you know, not run the whole thing because I was trying to gain weight and not expend a lot of calories.
Nice.
But coach did not like that. I was not on that team for a particularly long amount of time.
That's funny.
The track team, I did enjoy the sprinting, you know, running the 10 100s and 10 minutes and that sort of thing.
Yep.
But I would always get this pain on the anterior portion of my, you know, just distal to the gastroc, which, you know, at the time, 15, 16, I didn't know. It's like, oh, is this like a tendon or what's going on here? But more accurately, is the soleus muscle.
Yep.
And coach would just say, oh, that's just shin splints.
Shin splints on the back, reverse shin splints.
Yeah. So, I mean, I was like, oh, all right. But now I have actually been pleasantly surprised with the results of physical therapy.
Okay.
I went into this thinking, oh, this is probably going to be like a frustrating 4 to 6 weeks where I'm going to have, you know, minimal activity. But I took a total of 13 days off of running. And then I introduced some lower intensity running. I went back, did a little bit more intense running. This is more for, you know, speed work for like a 1 mile time as opposed to trying to run a 5K or a 10K. I suspect those would take a little bit longer to rehab.
Yep.
But I was pleasantly surprised just doing my prescribed exercises twice a day, every day, that the recovery has gone well. And the physical therapy location seems not surprised. They're like, yeah, this is what happens when people actually do their prescribed exercises. It just seems that there's a lot of missing follow through. I guess you could call it non-compliance, but some people don't like to use that word now.
Non-adherence is what you're supposed to call it.
Yeah, I see.
Wouldn't it be easier to just go to the chiropractor and get the rib that's out of place in your calf put back in place like 3 times a week? Just a little pop, snap. And then you could just go back to the chiropractor 2 to 3 times a week indefinitely
or just
for that.
Do peptides about it and not address anything else.
Oh, you did do BPC-157 for this, right?
No, I was thinking back about this. I think I took one shot of BPC-157 close to a year ago when I tweaked my pec.
Yeah.
I was incline bench pressing, you know, something, I think it was just above 250, and I was going for a set of six, I know, and then I felt a little something. So I racked the weight, and then I was like, man, I want to get back to this. And I think I had you give me a shot of the BPC.
One shot.
And
yeah, I did give you a shot.
I was like, yeah, I'll do a protocol of this. And then I thought about it and I was like, what would I really be getting out of, you know, a course of BPC? I was like, I'm probably going to heal up just fine. Like, there's no bruising, no swelling. Mm-hmm. It doesn't hurt except when I'm doing like bench press. So I just did light work for maybe a month, 6 weeks, and then slowly increased my weight back.
Recovered. What do you think the minimally efficacious dose of BPC is? Because we've had many critics, public critics, that say we are harming the public by underdosing peptides. Multiple people have said that. They all own peptide clinics, by the way, or research chemical peptide websites. But PRP works after just one shot. And that's also one of the primary mechanisms is VEGF in the PRP.
Yeah, I will say that there was no difference, say, the day before and the day after, even the week after the BPC shot. Did it kickstart something? Did it get a little bit more blood flow to the muscle area? Maybe. But I think that what most people would consider the efficacious dose would be above a single dose of 500 micrograms.
Yes.
You're certainly not going to make a lot of money if you're a research chemical company or a peptide clinic selling people single doses.
Yeah. Based off the animal studies, BPC might work better if you dose it daily or at least twice a week compared to, or sorry, every other day compared to twice a week or once a week. Mm-hmm. So more frequent dosing, at least in animal models, is better for BPC. And anecdotally with myself, and I would say dozens, probably not hundreds of patients at this point, because I'm not handing it out like candy. Like we're not a BPC 157 clinic. And now they're having to like change the names. They like put the sunglasses and the mustache on the BPC. And yeah. Some pharmacies aren't making it and whatnot. But I mean, at the end of the day, anecdotally, we know that it does work quite well. We're just trying to risk gratify and figure out what's the reasonable safe dose. And in myself, 2 week courses seem to be great. So I think one week, 2 weeks-ish, at least a couple doses is going to help significantly more than one dose.
Yeah, I think the total exposure does matter. I feel like some people who are younger and their body has more regenerative capacity, more growth hormone production, probably respond better to shorter courses. Whereas if someone is 65, they may need a larger total exposure in order to get that same outcome. Mm-hmm. Or a similar outcome in terms of the improvement. And
yep.
I really like to pair it with physical therapy, because a lot of times people will get injured or they'll have a surgery and it's like, this peptide may help you recover and get back to where you were more quickly. But if you're not addressing your sort of movement pattern or muscle imbalances, or you're not doing your prescribed physical therapy, you're going to go back to those same patterns and more than likely this is going to happen again.
Yeah, that's a good summary. And it's probably not because of the statin that you were on. By the way, your lipids are really good. Are you still on a statin?
I am. This is like the first time in over 5 years that I have been off statin therapy. Hmm. I think I started statin therapy in 2017 or 2018.
You finally realized they're toxic. Like Peter Attia, who's also not on a statin.
No, I just,
for a lot of patients.
Yeah, I had never been on just ezetimibe. So I was on ezetimibe and rosuvastatin for about a year. I think for an entire year, my LDL was below 30. And I didn't seem to have any untoward effects, nothing negative that I noticed.
It's a pretty Chad LDL.
Or a dangerously low LDL, depending on who you ask. I consider it a Chad LDL.
Is there such a thing as an LDL that's too low, though?
In general, no. Maybe if you have a rare, beta lipoproteinemia, where you basically don't have any LDL, I think that is problematic.
Yeah.
That's an example I could point to. For me, that answer is no. So I think the first question you were going to ask is, isn't that too low of an LDL, or is that too low of an LDL for you? Mm. And my answer would be, on an individual level, no. I do know some people, I think, even on lower intensity statins can have myalgias. I think it's about 5% of people. But for myself, I tend to be somewhat sore from exercising day to day. And I'm still somewhat sore from exercising day to day.
Correct.
I don't think I'm feel more anything. Sore.
Yeah. It was not the rosuvastatin that was causing my soreness. A lot of people, when they start a statin, it's because they've had a significant realization, like a metaphysical crisis, or all of a sudden they realize that those years of not exercising and drinking beer and having a processed food diet have caught up to them. And they're like, well, let's start a statin and start exercising, and they get muscle aches. And it must have been the statin. They stopped the statin, and they've finally been exercising enough to where they get less delayed onset muscle soreness. So they're like, oh, yeah, that was it. And it's the same thing if you look at the studies of people who do get statin-induced myalgias, which does happen. Hard to say if it's 10% or 20% of the people, but it's very likely dose-dependent. And in people who are not exercising, if you give them coenzyme Q10, they're not utilizing that. It's like you're studying cars that are sitting at home, not running, and
put some fuel stabilizer in there.
Yeah, you put some fuel stabilizer.
The car's still rusting away.
Yeah, not because they're burning up the fuel. If you look at athletes, it is my strong opinion that if they are deficient in CoQ10, which not unusually they are if they're on, I will say, both statins and PCSK9 inhibitors. We've seen deficient intracellular and serum coenzyme Q-tips.
An emerging pattern that's not well studied, actually.
If you ask the companies that make Repatha and Praluent and Leqvio, all of the PCSK9 or pseudo PCSK9, not inhibitors, but it doesn't let the protein get into the membrane, blah, 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 then all of them will say, well, we don't really know that. So if there's someone who's active that is on one of those medications, they should also be taking coenzyme Q10 and possibly PQQ and Shilajit as well, depending on their ApoE status. But that's a talk for another time. And I think we also mentioned that in my podcast with Dr. Tommy Wood. Anyways, after that rabbit trail, it looks like off statins, your HDL is around 50, your ApoB is around 75, and your homocysteine is around 7. A1C has skyrocketed from 4.7 to 5.0.
Oh, yeah, a couple things skyrocketed there. My homocysteine was 5 previously. Now it's
Gary
Brecker
would approve. It's under 6. No, wait, no, not him. The dementia guy.
Clinic.
Yeah, they would approve. Under 6 is what they like.
I want to say even in their own cognitive outcome studies, they didn't achieve homocysteine under 7, which is a target that I think they set. My homocysteine has always tended to be low. This isn't any sort of special supplementation. I do take a multivitamin that might have 200 or 400 micrograms of some methylated folic acid or B12 in there. I don't really recall, but I don't take any specific methylation support. I do pretty consistently take a scoop of creatine. That's probably 5 to 7 days a week, depending. And I am also compound heterozygote, so two mutations and no correlation, in my case, at least with homocysteine levels. I can't think of a lab I've had where it has actually been elevated above 9.
That's not convenient. That's one of the main genes for functional medicine and clinical genetics.
Yeah, I am not a good patient for them. If they did my gene test and then they were going to follow it up with a blood test, the gene test they would be very excited about. They say, oh, we've got something here.
Yeah.
And then when they got the
blood
test. You
need expensive supplementation.
Yeah. They would probably give me the supplementation before the blood test.
You need
expensive. And then I get the blood test and they would say, oh, look, it worked.
You need expensive genetic tests. Something is wrong with your methylation. You should not be methylating as well as you are.
Technically, I don't know my confirmed MTHFR status. That's just from a 23andMe that I ran through. It may have been Rhonda Patrick's software thing, but that told me I was a compound heterozygote. So it's not clinically confirmed technically, but everything else that I've clinically confirmed from the 23andMe has lined up.
Yeah, well, that's looking pretty good. What did it say about your heavy metal toxicities? Because we tested some metals here. Your zinc looked borderline low. Your magnesium intracellular looked kind of mid-normal. Your selenium was good too, so you must have 3 Brazil nuts every day.
I have a handful of nuts in the morning, and sometimes there's a Brazil nut in that mixed nut. Salted nuts from Costco. So I don't do anything specific for selenium. There might be like 100 micrograms, 200 micrograms in the multivitamin that I take. The zinc, that was surprising to me. I don't know if I trust that one. Because
I bet your intracellular is high.
My prior serum zinc was 100, but that was LabCorp, and this is a different lab.
Serum zinc and serum iron, depending on many factors, will spike up and spike down. So unless you have an RBC iron, or is it zinc and RBC or WBC or both?
Zinc is RBC. I don't know if there's an RBC iron study.
I think there's definitely a WBC. I think there is an RBC iron, but I don't remember which lab it's with. But either way, you want to get your intracellular test for both zinc and iron when possible. But if you're just trending a serum zinc, then that's reasonable to do as well. Intracellular omega checks is, you definitely want that over a serum omega. LabCorp's omega is actually a serum omega, which you can cheat. You can eat more or less omegas and it'll be skewed. So you want either the omega quant test or an RBC omega from a different lab. And yours were good. So you must be taking, what expensive brand of omega are we taking that we can plug our discount code for?
Yeah. So I actually take two different kinds of omegas. And this would actually be a good time to get feedback from the listeners. I said feedback, not kickback.
Feedback.
Yeah. If there is a product out there that is a higher ratio of DHA to EPA, where someone could just take two pills of the same product, I haven't seen it yet. But if someone knows of one, please leave it down there in the comments.
Carlson DHA Gym.
Yeah. That is
off Amazon is what I take, actually.
Yeah.
Carlson has an official store. 1 gram of DHA and that's it.
I take 1 gram of the Carlson DHA and I take 1 gram of the omega-3 ethyl ester from Mark Cuban's pharmacy. So
how
a
much,
total of about, yeah, what does that work out to? Like 1,700 of total omega-3s that I'm taking in supplement form. Not even anywhere close to, yeah, the sort of 4 to 6 grams that a lot of influencers will promote as optimal.
It's actually exactly what I take, but I do get Maddie, my wife, the Designs for Health DHA. It's a nicer packaging, the soft gels, like a little smoother, looks like it's a higher quality. But actually I also take the Mark Cuban omega-3 ethyl ester and the Carlson DHA 1 gram gym as well. And it looks like your omegas are going pretty well. These are RBC, so you can't cheat that test. That's 3 to 4 months of
I am
your
pretty,
average.
Pretty consistent with the supplementation. I would bet that yours is even higher. I think you consume more sort of canned sardines, canned salmon than I do. I do try to get sort of salmon, shrimp, those sorts of things in my diet, yep, at least a couple times a week. But yeah, I don't think I'm quite on your level. I don't have an aquarium built in the clinic to hold my canned fish.
Yeah, like I do have an aquarium. Yeah, I realized last week, actually, Amanda, one of the other nurse practitioners, informed me that salmon also smells like fish, which I actually didn't realize. I don't have a very strong sense of smell because I thought that the herring and the sardines and the mackerel that I eat, I was like, and the tuna, I was like, all right, this smells strongly of fish. So I go on the patio, I eat it, I throw away the can, and then I take out the can from the trash if it smells. But apparently the cans of salmon that I eat just regularly in the kitchen also smell. So I'm going to eat those outside as well. Get some sunlight while I do so.
Oh, you're stacking health benefits.
Yeah, I guess so.
Although getting less light into the retina currently.
Yeah, it'll be a couple more days until the eyes fully recover. But yeah, I think that mostly sums it up for our various health updates. Hopefully people could take away things, even though there's not really anything specific to their health. And when we do these podcasts, it kind of feels like we're not really providing the public with a good service. I know we like the channel JJ Medicine on YouTube quite a bit. And that channel has excellent pointed things, you know, specifically about each medical topic from, I believe when he started his channel, I think he was a medical resident. Now I think he's an internal medicine physician. But we like that. This is kind of the opposite. It's, you know, people like to hear about other individuals' health. So hopefully you were entertained.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a lot of people that are, you know, it's sort of into the mindset of, well, tell me what you do. And just because these are things that we have done doesn't mean that they're necessarily right for you. And I used to be pretty hesitant about talking about, oh, this is what I do for exercise. I take this supplement, because there's a lot of different variables that go into making a health decision for someone. But from a sort of curiosity standpoint, it's the same reason that people will, you know, follow a celebrity or a certain influencer. They want to know, you know, what's going on in this person's life? What are they doing?
What personal hygiene product are they using?
Yeah. I mean, literally any detail.
Yep. Yeah. How did Chris Hemsworth get such huge biceps and small calves? Like literally any detail. It's kind of funny. But anyway, if you had any questions about this or any thoughts, please comment below as always. If there's any suggestions or other things that you're interested in our lives or any of the other individuals at the clinic or whatnot, we could potentially talk about it depending on what it is. So, but yeah, we appreciate any comments and feedback.
Yeah. Thank you for watching, and may God bless you with health and happiness.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Cenovus.com. Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Cenovus.com.